You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Spotlight with Stacey Pinkerton.
I would like to bring on my next guest, who is Tom Whipple. He is, I assume it's a he, written the book X and Y, The Rules of Attraction, Why Gender Still Matters. Good evening, Tom.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
I took the presumption of thinking that you were a male because of the name Tom. That is wrong after reading this book. I want to congratulate you on the book, X and Y. You must have had a lot of fun and laughs researching the topics and subjects of the book.
I did. I mean, it's a book about sex, and I think everyone enjoys sex, everyone enjoys talking about sex, everyone enjoys lots of aspects of sex, and I got to write a whole book about it, which was, as you say, it was a lot of fun. I went to a lot of interesting places and saw some interesting things and some things that maybe I won't want to see again, but yes, it was fun.
You say everyone likes to talk about sex. I find it the opposite. They like to hear other people talking about it, but they don't like to talk about it.
Possibly, yes. Yeah, my mother wasn't as happy talking about sex with me about this book, but it's been good fun. So the book, I started the book because I heard about this marvelous study. I'm a science writer, and it was a study where a bunch of students in Florida State University got sent out into the campus, and they were told to approach people of the opposite sex and ask one question. And the question was, they'd say, "I've noticed you around. I find you very attractive. Would you go to bed with me?" And the women got 2/3 of men said yes, despite the fact that nothing in their lives had told them this was a plausible or realistic offer. They said, "Yeah, I'm going to take this opportunity. I'm going to go to bed with you." And the third who said no apologized. They said, "I'm really sorry. I can't do tonight. Could we do tomorrow?" Or, you know, they'd say, this is a lovely offer, but I'm afraid I'm married. Whereas the men who asked exactly the same question and approached women, they had zero people saying yes. And this experiment has been repeated so many times, and it's been repeated en masse on Tinder. People have sent out these bots that have swiped everyone in the whole of New York. They've said, "I'm available to offers from everyone," and the female bot got 10% of the eligible males in New York saying, "Yes, this is great, I'm yours." And the male bot got 0.6%, and it turned out that 90% of them were men. And it was such an interesting study, and I thought maybe this is the crux of gender. Maybe we spend all of our time talking about, oh, you know, maybe men are better at maths, maybe women are better at this, maybe women can park cars better, or all of this stuff, but it's so far removed from the most fundamental thing, that's sex. So I decided I would just look at sex for my book.
Well, it is just an act, and it seems that it never really has changed over the time.
No, I think there's everything changes, but everything stays the same. Culture can make lots and lots of differences, but that experiment, what that was looking at was this idea that men would be more comfortable with casual sex. And the reason for that, well, there'll be two reasons. There's one reason, which is women might be scared if some man approaches you in the street and says, I want to have sex with you. That's quite a scary prospect. Men don't find that scary, and men don't get pregnant. And it's such a fundamental thing. I realized that when everyone's talking about these new debates about gender, which we have to have and which are really important, and where we're saying, you know, obviously women can be scientists, obviously men can look after the kids or be nurses, but when we're talking about these things, it strikes me there's still these fundamental things. Men do not get pregnant, women do have a menopause, and if these, and lots of other things, if these differences in our biology don't translate into behavior, if the fact that if I have sex with someone, the least I need to invest is 10 minutes of my time, maybe less, you know, and, you know, a glass of wine. Whereas if a woman has sex with someone, she knows that she is risking getting pregnant. And if you don't see effects in behavior as a consequence of that, then evolution doesn't work. And of course you see effects. You see effects all over the place because of that.
Yeah, there's one thing that I'm going to quote from your book, that a womb is not a patriarchy. Creation, which is very important to talk about that subject as well, because well, you've just touched on it. It's an interesting point in the book. If, for instance, gender is really social construct, if there's no such thing as a male and a female brain, should we operate on people whose brain tells them they are different sex? Talk about that, Tom.
Well, yeah, so there are two very interesting social trends happening at the same time, and they are, to an extent, completely contradictory. On the one hand, we've got this big debate about transgenderism, where people are saying that they so fundamentally believe that they are not the gender that represents the body they were born into, that they want to change that gender, that they want to take hormones, that they want to, you know, get operated on, do these really fundamental things where you have to say, this is not some passing whim, this is clearly a great urge. And then on the other hand, you've got people saying that gender doesn't matter. And those two things cannot coexist. And the interesting thing is, I don't know where we're going to end up with the transgender debate. It's so early. What we do know is that transgender people have existed through history at a population rate of about 1 in 300. They do, and this is early research in small studies, they do seem to have differences in their brains, and where those differences exist, they seem to map onto things that happen structurally in the brain of people of the other sex. So there's something very interesting going on there. What I don't think we're going to find is that we're an entirely gender-fluid society and we can choose the gender we want. I think we're going to find that there's a group of people who have a very strong urge, and they always have done. I think we'll probably find that it'll still be about 1 in 300 people.
Yeah. When it comes to sexuality, there is no truth. There's only partial truth. As you said earlier, sex is part of evolution. Why can't we accept that, Tom?
I think that people have been people have misused this science, and they've mapped it onto the social prejudices of their time. So you have, you know, Darwin, the father of evolution, was not a feminist. You know, he said that he studied this particular aspect of evolution, which is sexual selection, and his idea was, which is partially true, that men will compete amongst themselves for women, because if you think about it, the women hold the power in this, because they're the ones who are going to make the biggest sacrifice, whereas the men are the ones who are far keener on casual sex, so they're the ones who are going to be competing. And his idea was, well, if men are competing amongst themselves, that's going to cause them to evolve and sort of hone their organism. And he said, well, this means women must be inferior. It's ludicrously simplistic, and it's not true. And I think people have, women in particular, for obvious reasons, and feminists, have recoiled from these evolutionary narratives because they often end up in that way. And I think we need to reassess. And I understand why women, there'd be this strong push to say actually men and women are exactly the same. Because if you're exactly the same, then everything you see that is an inequality can be explained by something that society is doing wrong. But if you're not exactly the same, then you have to think slightly more complicatedly about this. And you have to think, you know, maybe we behave in these different ways for reasons. But I understand why certain branches of feminism would be very, very wary of this sort of thing. I completely get it. And that's one reason why in my book I was just talking about people having sex. And it's a long way from the workplace.
it's less complicated sometimes, isn't it? one thing that made me laugh in your book, the XNY, that's W-H-Y, very clever.
Thank you for spelling it out.
In the study after study, scientists show men consistently overrate their own sexual romantic appeal.
Yeah. And I mean, it's fun. You will have speed dating studies where the men will be asked, you know, and how attractive do you think she found you? And they will all think they're brilliant. Whereas with women, the bias almost goes the other way. You know, women will generally think, they will generally have a very low opinion of men. If you look, for instance, at online dating, where we now have all of this data, and you see how women rate the attractiveness of all of these men, well, it's a very rare man who gets 6 out of 10. Whereas men are busily rating women all as attractive. And the reason for this, at least the reason that's posited, is, again, for a man, if you think you've got a chance, you should definitely have a go because you've got nothing to lose. You're not the one who's going to be left literally holding the baby at the end of this. So you might as well think in every scenario where you go in and, you know, the cashier flirts with you or the waitress seems to bat her eyelids, you might as well think, bless you, that you really have a chance at this. Whereas for women, you know, you want to be a bit warier of this because this is actually a reasonable investment. But, I mean, I've got another theory, and I didn't see anyone who studied this, but I remember being a teenage boy, and I just think if you had a true understanding of how attractive you are to women at that age, then you'd just kill yourself. I mean, I don't think you could get through being a teenage boy without having some self-delusion about your own attractiveness. Because, you know, otherwise you'd just give up going to nightclubs and trying to meet girls.
Yeah, talking about attractiveness, more attractive men have more sexual partners and more attractive women do not.
Yeah. It's women seem to use their attractiveness to gain higher quality, better men, whereas men seem to use their attractiveness to just, get as many as possible. And this, you know, this ties into things we find that men are more likely to break their vows if they're a priest. You know, if you're a priest, you're more likely to not be celibate than if you're a nun, which was an amazing study for someone to do, going around quizzing priests and nuns. And you find that if you ask men at the end of their lives what they regret, men will say they regret the times that they didn't have sex when they could have, whereas women will say that they regret the times that they did have sex and they shouldn't have. But this is all fascinating, but there's one little bit where you realize, and I realized, that all of this has to be taken with a small pinch of salt, because one of the best known sex statistics, and this works in every country in the world throughout history, is that if you ask men and women how many sexual partners they've had over their lives, you will find that men on average will say one number, and women on average will say a number that's about 2/3 of that. Yeah. And so you look at that and you think, oh, this completely fits into everything else you studied. But then a mathematician comes along and says, that is statistically impossible. It's not showing that men and women have different number of sexual partners, because for heterosexual men and women, that's impossible. It has to be exactly the same amount. What it's actually showing is that people don't quite tell the truth.
That was my next point. I was going to say someone must be lying because the math just does not add up.
There's always one person involved, one person on either side of this transaction. So you cannot, the numbers have to be the same. So it looks like, in this particular case, lots of people have studied it. Because they know that this is wrong, and they know it pops up all the time. So one of the reasons is that it's very rare that if you knock on the door of a brothel and say, I'm a social scientist, I want to ask you some questions, that they're going to say, yes, please, sit down. So it turns out that prostitutes are going to be left out of these surveys. So that excludes a lot of women who've had a lot of sex. But also, there's a strong element of counting up and counting down. If you ask a woman, and there's been studies that have looked into this, if you ask a woman about how many times they've had sex, she'll go back and she'll think about the different encounters and she'll think, oh, no, that one didn't really count. We only did that. Or this, no, that one, I don't think that one was the case. Whereas with men, they'll do exactly the opposite. They'll count everything. They'll try to big up their numbers, you know, that sort of, that dodgy fumble that went wrong all that time they were too drunk, all of that will be counted in. And what you end up is you end up getting this gap, and it tells you as much about the people's attitudes to sex as about what is actually going on with the sex.
Yeah, well, we'll have to ask or take into account Bill Clinton's definition of sex.
Well, exactly, yeah. that's not really sex defense. Yes. You'll get people thinking the same. So they have to be very explicit in all ways, about what they're defining as sex when they ask the question.
Yeah. And why is it that men can be socially accepted to sleep with many women, but women are not looked at the same way? They fall from being desired to the bottom. Why?
Yeah.
Why? That's hypocrisy.
It's hypocrisy. It's not fair. It's not right. And hopefully it's changing. And I think it is changing. And this is one of the examples of things where society can change things. But is it surprising? I'd say no. And the reason I'd say no is because of a huge advantage that women have in sex. So what I've been talking about is, oh, it's easy for the man. He doesn't, you know, he's not the one who has to get pregnant, all of this. But the one great advantage, and it's massive, that women have in sex is they are always certain that the baby they produce is theirs. There's no woman who thinks in the labor ward, oh, is it mine? Could it be his other girlfriend's? No, they know that baby came out of them. And so this means that on the other hand, with men, there's always this suspicion. And you can see in clever studies that men who have the highest suspicion that the baby might not be theirs are also those who end up investing the least in that baby. And so men want to be sure, and have historically wanted to be sure, that the baby is theirs. And those that did better evolutionarily, those that got their genes furthest, were the ones who were most sure that the genes that they were supporting in the form of a baby were those that were theirs. And so you end up with the fact that, you know, always historically there is this premium on virginity in women but not in men, and that there is this idea that it's fine for men to have lots of sex but not women. And what you're seeing here is this coming out, and you can see it coming out in lots of ways. You can see it coming out in lots of unpleasant ways. There's this thing that lots of animals do called mate guarding, which is literally that, where you make sure no one's getting at your mate. And you can see octopuses do that, you can see fish do that, and you can see that humans do it. I mean, what else is putting your wife in a burqa and making sure she only ever goes out with her relatives and keeping her locked up all the rest of the time but mate guarding? And so everywhere you see this dynamic popping up, and it's perfectly possible you can hold two thoughts in your head. You can say, I understand why this exists, I understand why this is natural, but you can also say this is completely wrong. And this is something that we need to change as society. And we're good at changing things as society. One of the biggest things we've changed is that we are monogamous. We have one man married to one woman. This is a very strange state of human affairs that we have this, but it's far better for society that we do. But it's against all of our nature.
Yeah, even you touch that up on your book, The Size of Testicles, and humans do not have monogamous testicles.
No, so this is one of the simplest ways of working out what goes on
actually in women. So this idea which Darwin had that women were these coy and chaste animals who waited for the men to compete and then went with the victor. Well, our testicles say that's nonsense because... So if you, the simplest way of explaining it is look at chimpanzees and look at gorillas. Now, gorillas are big, scary animals, but they have tiny testicles because gorilla females are not promiscuous. They will only have sex with the gorilla who controls the harem, the gorilla who the silverback who leads the pack. So those gorillas don't need to make lots of sperm because they know their sperm is going to be the only sperm that's inside the female gorillas. Whereas if you're a chimpanzee and you're having sex all of the time, well, the male chimpanzees compete on sperm. They try to drown out the competition. They produce enough sperm that hopefully some of theirs will get through to the end. So you can look at testicles and find out roughly how promiscuous females are. And we find that human testicles are somewhere between gorillas and chimpanzees. They're definitely not monogamous testicles.
Interesting stuff. Two-thirds of men say they would use a sex robot, while two-thirds of women said they would not. One, my question to you, Tom, is, isn't using a vibrator sort of the same thing? Why aren't they taking that into consideration?
That's a really interesting question that I thought about. I think you'd probably find, well, you do find that, that women masturbate less. So the use of a vibrator is, if there was a male equivalent, which there isn't, well, I suppose there is. It's probably used less often than men would use their hand or something else. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we don't have sex robots, and you ask these questions, and it's very, very early days, and I'd love to see how sex robots will change society, or maybe I wouldn't. And yes, we might well find that actually, for all of them answering the question that way, perhaps because they think that's what the person surveying them wants to hear as well, we might find that women are just into sex robots as men, in which case the human species is doomed, because none of us are going to bother with the real thing.
It's interesting to know what the future holds as far as sex. Regarding the dating market, what changes have you seen?
So, I mean, in some ways, surprisingly few. We've got, as I mentioned at the beginning, we've got Tinder. But if you conduct the same experiments on Tinder, you find the same outcomes. You find that men are trying everyone and that women are being choosy. One of the most interesting things that came out of the dating market was, do you remember the Ashley Madison hack?
Yes.
The website, so it was a website you could go on to have extramarital affairs, and you could do it completely anonymously. So for the first time probably in human history, this was something where you'd almost taken the risk out of it. You knew that everyone on this wanted an affair, so there was no risk of does she, doesn't he, does he, doesn't he. You could go on, you could organize it, you could do it. And then it was hacked, and they released all of the names of the people who'd signed up. And this was meant to be a public relations disaster for Ashley Madison because... because they'd lost all the names, and of course that was bad. But it was really a public relations disaster because they discovered that almost everyone was men. Ashley Madison did not actually facilitate almost no sexual liaisons happened because of this. There were 35 million names, 30 million names were men, and most of the other 5 million women on that site, it turned out, were robots. They were there to just keep the men chatting so that they could keep on paying money to Ashley Madison. So we're seeing the same things coming out.
What a scandal.
I find it quite funny, all of these men talking to robots thinking they're going to have sex.
You men, I tell you. What about the beer goggle effect?
I wrote about this recently. The beer goggles, I don't know if it's definitely an English term in Britain, but the idea that the more you drink, the more attractive other people become. And it's been validated. There's been several studies, I think more than 1,000 people who people have got drunk in laboratories and got them to rate pictures of members of the opposite sex. And they found indeed, yeah, that the more you drink, the more attractive people get. And you can look at this two ways. The researchers thought that this meant that alcohol will facilitate more risky sex, which it will, although I think that's probably not because people are finding people more attractive. It's just because they're getting drunk and losing their inhibitions. But the writer, you know, Ovid, 2,000 years ago, knew about this, and his view was, well, this is how you get society to work and everyone reproducing. So, I don't know, somewhere in between. I'm sure we'd reproduce without alcohol, but I think British people in particular would have trouble.
Well, obviously. I wanted to touch base on testosterone and aggression. Have you seen any difference in the studies regarding testosterone?
Testosterone is really interesting because if you look in animals, you will see that if you give them more testosterone, they become more aggressive. And that's something that you'd expect to see in humans. And it's a bit more nuanced than that. Now, from my book, I did several things. I went to an orgy. I took part in various scientific experiments. But I also bought testosterone. I bought it illegally on the dark web because you can't get it prescribed unless you need it. And I tried it out, so I rubbed it all over my back to see if there was much difference. And my wife wasn't happy. She got increasingly unhappy as this book went on. But not as unhappy as the time that I went to the orgy. That was probably a marital low point. I rubbed this on my back, and I didn't feel much different. But from what I'd read, I didn't particularly expect to, because one of the things that testosterone probably does is it makes you more likely to want to compete and seek status. And now, if I was a deer, then the only way to do that would be to fight and fight harder. But as humans, we have lots of different and more nuanced ways to seek status. So you'll find interesting things, you know, chess players, their testosterone will be raised before a match if they win. After a match, if they win, it will lower if they lose, if they're in sort of submissive posture, like the deer that's just lost a fight. But they're playing chess. You know, these guys are not deers. They're not stags who win fights. They're people who play chess. And you'll also find that it'll make men sometimes behave better if behaving better is a way of gaining status. But then there are the traditional effects that you might be more familiar with, which the really interesting experiment in transgender people, because if you're transitioning from being a man to a woman to a man, you suddenly have to take all of this testosterone, and you suddenly experience, I guess, a little bit of what it is to be a man, and you'll get these people will say, look, suddenly I realized that I understood men. It was all about sex. I had this testosterone. I just couldn't stop thinking about sex. You know, yeah. Masturbation became a daily necessity rather than a sort of a brief hobby. And you get all this. But testosterone's interesting, and it's more nuanced. It seems to be different from the simple effects it has in animals.
Well, it's quite an amazing book that you've written, and it's called The X and Y, The Rules of Attraction, Why Gender Still Matters. Tom Whipple, who is also the science editor of The Times, and he draws the latest science to look at key questions about the difference between the sexes and unpack the central psychology of our relationships, touching on everything from male promiscuity, female promiscuity, to menopause, transgender, monogamy, you name it. What was the most exciting, fun thing that you discovered?
I had a very, very enjoyable time getting wired up to a genital blood flow checker to see how I responded to porn, the very brief version of that is men, if they say they're straight, they will only respond to straight porn. If they say they're gay, they'll only respond to gay porn. For women, it's a lot more ambiguous and a lot more interesting. And no one's completely sure why. But the weirdest part of that was that between the porn clips, they had a palate cleanser, something to bring you down. And they showed you wildlife documentaries. So you'd suddenly be watching hardcore porn. And then up would pop a gazelle or a dolphin, and you think, oh God, I must not get turned on by a dolphin, which happened. The scientist confessed to me that they had someone who, it turned out, was attracted to dolphins, and they didn't know what to do because the experiment didn't work. But on the other hand, they were very excited because they'd found someone attracted to dolphins.
Well, to each his own. Tom, it's I invite this book. This book is for everyone, basically. It will help you discover whatever turns you on if you don't know. And
even dolphins.
It's been a pleasure, Tom. Thank you for joining me.
And thank you very much.
The book is also on our TRE bookshop, and the book is called X and Y, W-H-Y, The Rules of Attraction, Why Gender Still Matters. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Been a pleasure.
Bye. TRE, Talk Radio Europe.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time, and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.